You know, when you go to places that you know have been set in films and you're like, okay, sure, I can see how they might have like pointed the camera in that direction. But this was like immersive, like the whole place is like a film setting. It was incredible. It really was like being Game of Thrones or something. I love.
That's so cool. That really is really, really cool. It's somewhere that I've known quite a few people go recently. I'm not sure if they've just made flights like way cheaper or they've just like upped the marketing budget for Malta or something. Yeah. Or maybe it's because it's like from the UK at least, not a very long flight. Like a friend of mine's been to two weddings there.
If you don't mind like heat, it would be a beautiful place to have a wedding because it's just so like sandstony and old. And yeah, it was just really, really cool. Pretty unique. And then we also went to Crete, which was wonderful. And you've just had a bunch of visitors, right? You had a string of people staying with you. Is that like June, July?
Yes, maybe.
She looks so vague.
Oh.
You were talking about all these people coming to stay with you. You're looking at your calendar.
I am looking at my calendar. We had loads. And I'm like, when do we have people to stay? So hang on, I'm clicking back through my diary. And welcome to the Bookcast Club, a podcast for people who like to chat books. I'm Alice, coming at you from London, UK. And she's Sarah, coming at you from the Netherlands. And today we're going to chat to you about books with a really strong sense of place. And I can't remember what I need to say after that.
Nothing.
Nothing. Leave it there.
We've just been having a long chat about our holidays, actually. I've been in Malta, which is what we were talking about at the beginning. I'm not sure how well that will cut in, but... And Crete, and Alice has been... Where have you been? Italy, you said.
Italy and France. I went to a wedding in Italy on the Amalfi Coast. So I can't really complain that I've not been anywhere because I've been to some great places, which was amazing. Like, really, really, really good fun.
Yeah, your photos looked incredible.
It was next level. It was so ridiculous, but amazing. And also a wedding in France, the south of France, about 10 days after I got back from that one. So my liver isn't very happy right now. My passport is. And yeah, just sort of trying to cope with the heat, really. Those are the main things for me. It's just been absolutely boiling and I can't cope with it. And I know this is the most British thing in the world to just keep going on and on about the weather. But it's, yeah, we've also just had a drought declared in England, which is really scary, to be quite honest. And also just hilarious when you think about England being famously rainy, we're in a drought. Like, London has had something like 7% of the normal rainfall for the year. It's insane. I can't tell you the last time we had like a proper rainstorm. It's really, really weird. So what have you been reading recently?
What have I been reading recently? I've been reading quite a lot of Booker books. I've been getting through a bit of the long list because I've just had this holiday that we've just had this long conversation about. And I read three of the long-listed books, actually, while I was there. So I've read Booth by Karen Joy Fowler, and I read Small Things Like These by Claire Keegan, and I read, what was the third one? Case Study by Graham McRae Burnett, which is the one out of the three of the long list. It's definitely the one I enjoyed the most. That's about, you know, when you get someone who gets scraps of some kind of nonfiction event, be they letters, documents, whatever, and they kind of fictionalize that. He's setting it up as if that's what he's done. But the whole thing is actually fiction. So it starts off with this author's note, and he's like, "Oh, so this is a story about this psychotherapist in the 60s who was doing a lot of malpractice, and a woman died by suicide who was one of his patients, and it's quite suspicious, and there's suspicion that he kind of encouraged her to suicide." And he's talking about how the sister of this woman got very suspicious about what the psychotherapist had been doing. And so she went into his practice as a patient because she wanted to talk to him and see what he was doing. And he found her diary where she kind of recorded all of her interactions with the psychotherapist. And he said, "I've tried to piece this together and to see what happened. And this is my retelling. I've had to fill in quite a few details, but this is to the best of my knowledge what happened." But it's all fiction and it reads completely like nonfiction. Like, he totally got me. As I was reading it, I was critiquing the way that he'd portrayed this woman and the way that he'd chosen to translate her letters, which were all fiction. It was crazy. It's a very, very interesting book. I really, really enjoyed that.
Yeah, it sounds incredible. I love that really clever concept of taking a genre or a style that is well known and just totally fictionalizing. And that sounds really, really clever. And it sounds like a really great topic as well. So you've just read the first three, haven't you?
So those are three I've read, yeah.
Any more that are on your list that you're excited about?
Yeah, they're all... available in my library, so I'm just sort of like, I just got them all out, to be honest. I put them all on hold. I was like, whatever, sure. And then I'm just sort of going to pick them all up and see which one's taken, which one's not. Booth I found okay. It was, that's the one about the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, which on paper, because I really like kind of early America, that sort of period, I find it very interesting. On paper, it's the kind of book that I would really like, but in practice, I didn't like it so much. Booth is the surname of the guy who assassinated Lincoln. She says in the author's note that she wanted to like tell a story about this family and how he got to this point without centering him, but it's like about his family and he's in it the whole time. So I was like, that's a bit of an odd choice to say that you don't want to center the person that you have centered the book around, but whatever. The characters aren't super strong. That kind of like big epic historical fiction where you're following a family through many generations, for that I really like the characters to be really warm, to feel like you know the characters well. Kind of, it's missing that kind of like warm humor that I really like in those kind of books. So yeah, I didn't like it as much as I thought I would. In fact, I didn't like it that much at all, to be honest. What was your question?
She asked if there were any of the others that you were really excited to read.
Oh, right, sorry.
I love this. This is great.
What am I looking forward to? I'm really looking forward to Trust by Hernan Diaz. That's got some really, really good reviews. And then for the rest, I kind of try and stay away from reading too much about them because the book of books gets so saturated that I try and just go into them a bit blind.
It's really easy to kind of go into them knowing everything about them before you've even lifted the first, like, lifted the
exactly
cover.
Yeah, and I try not to read new reviews before I've read them because they influence me.
Smart idea. I'm really excited for Night Crawling. That one looks so good and so interesting. We had like a big discussion in our podcast WhatsApp group around how the author is so young and it makes everyone feel like a massive underachiever. Yeah. Because she wrote this when she was about 18, I think. She's only about 20 now, and it's just getting absolute rave reviews and sounds unbelievably good. So really dark, and I think it's going to be quite a difficult read, but it does just sound fantastic. And I'm not at all jealous, not at all jealous that she's managed to write this epic like Booker nominated book at the age, well, as a teenager.
I think she's the youngest person ever longlisted, right?
Yes. Yeah, this year's got the youngest and the oldest people longlisted, which is really cool.
What have you been reading?
So I've been reading things that are a lot less highbrow than Booker nominated books. So one of the books I read when I was on holiday, because I forgot to take the book I was reading away with me, I kind of got to the airport and was like, I don't have a book with me. I'm going to have to go straight into Waterstones. Oh no, what a hardship.
I think that's exciting though, to like go with nothing and then find a book and read it.
True, but I will say I do find airport bookshops to quite often be just jam-packed with sort of blockbuster thrillers and
that's true,
not necessarily my kind of books a lot of the time.
It's like The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck.
Exactly. All that kind of stuff that is great for a lot of people, just not to my tastes. But I did find and pick up How to Kill Your Family by Bella Mackey, which is everywhere this summer, like all over my Instagram, the millennial pink cover with How to Kill Your Family in massive letters. Almost everyone I've seen on Instagram has been like, people are giving me really weird looks, like, why was I reading this book about how to kill my family? I mean, it's quite clearly a novel, so I'm not sure if people actually are getting the questions that they're claiming to get and the weird looks that they're claiming to get, but maybe I'm just being a bit of a cynic there. I quite liked it. It's really quite a good, it's a really good summer read. It's very pacey, bit repetitive. So in terms of concept, the story is about Grace, who is, for various reasons that if I go into too much detail about, we'll spoil the whole book, but for various reasons, it has got a list of people she wants to murder and is making her way through that list. And it is it's very clever, it's very pacey. I found bits of it a little bit repetitive in that there was, so the book opens with her in prison and it kind of cycles through a chapter format, which is a snippet of her life in prison, some background to one of the murders, the murder actually happening, and then we're back to her life in prison. It's a very cyclical kind of story and it goes through this a number of times. But I think it's not a long book, but I do think it probably would have benefited from a slightly heavier edit. It's got some real superfluous stuff in it that I was just like, this isn't getting us anywhere, and it's not giving any kind of additional context or background or depth to the story. But that just might be the fact that I liked it but didn't love it, that I was thinking that if somebody loved this book, they probably would really like all that superfluous detail. And I think one of the interesting things is that, like, in some of the reviews at the beginning of the book, there are people comparing Grace to, like, Patrick Bateman or Tom Ripley or kind of some of these real sort of psychopaths from classic literature. And I don't think that she's anywhere near as good an anti-hero as either of those. She's actually, I felt quite neutral about her. She's very spoiled. She's very self-centered. And I wasn't sure that she actually felt very well developed in some ways. Like, her motivations were clear, but also it's a bit of a leap as to how somebody could go from some of her experiences to what she did. And I couldn't necessarily put that together, if that makes sense. There were also just issues for me, like how she seemed to have limitless funds and limitless annual leave from her job, which just didn't make any sense to me. And I also, my friend Becca was like, this is the weirdest thing that you've pulled out, that this is your big problem with the book. Her mother is French, and I just don't think a French woman would call her daughter Grace, because when you say it in French, it's pronounced really differently and it's quite a harsh name. And I just didn't think it's a very French name at all. And it just really struck me. And I was like, I don't understand why her name is Grace, and it makes no sense. But that might just be me.
That's funny. It doesn't seem to have that same sinister undertone. It makes me think of that character in Game of Thrones. I've forgotten her name, but the one who has that kill list that she says every night, and she like recites them. Doesn't seem to have that same like sinister undertone that I would want in a book like that.
Definitely not. It's definitely more of a romp than a you know, sinister, challenging book. Also, there's a bit of a twist in the book, which I just didn't like. And it really put me off the whole book. As I was going through it, I was thinking, oh yeah, this is probably like a 4-star from me. Obviously, there's various issues, but I really like it. Good beach read. And then this twist happened and I was like, straight down to 3 stars. The twist did absolutely nothing for me. Yeah, I struggled a bit with it, but it's a really good summer read. It's a really, really good, easy race through it. Pick it up, put it down. I think I can see why it's on everybody's like summer reads list this year. But would I look to pick up another novel by Bella Mackey? Maybe not. But worth reading. Worth keeping an eye out for. I'm not reading anything like right now because I just finished Krista Bilton's Normal Family with the subtitle On Truth, Love and How I Met My 35 Siblings. And I don't know if you've heard anything about this book.
No, never.
So it's really cool. It's really interesting non-fiction. So I've just listened to it as an audiobook, which, keeping up with my New Year's resolutions, by the way, more audiobooks, more non-fiction. And it works really well as an audiobook because she reads it herself, which I think always adds a great deal. So it's a story of Krista and her experiences growing up as the child of a gay mother who in the 80s decided she wanted to be a mother on her own. And therefore approached a sperm donor in a hairdresser's. This is not a spoiler by any means. This is in a lot of the blurbs. She approached this man in the hairdresser's, and it's the experiences of what happened, the conception, all the way through Krista's childhood, young adulthood, pretty much up to the current day. One of the key things about this is that Krista's mother asked her father not to be a sperm donor for anybody else. And for various reasons, which I won't go into, you'll have to read it to find them out, he did not stick by that agreement and actually became one of the most prolific sperm donors in the sperm bank's history. At one point, there was a 6-month waiting list for his sperm. While she's met 35 or so of her siblings, the theory is that there's probably hundreds. I really, really enjoyed this. It's a real kind of autobiography, really, of just her childhood growing up with her single mother and her younger sister, and everything oscillates wildly between they had times of great wealth and great success and times of having literally nothing. And this was a pattern that was repeating throughout their lives. They grew up in LA, so there's some amazing kind of stories about some of the people they came across and some of the people that her mother kind of was involved with. I would have liked a bit more depth on this sounds really weird, but on like the history of sperm donation and how this worked and how this became much more of an accepted thing. You know, there's, I as far as I'm aware, I don't know anyone personally who's gone down that route, but it's something that people do as quite a standard thing these days. But back in the 80s was a really unusual path to take, and particularly as a single gay woman, that's a real challenge in the 80s in a way that it's maybe not quite such a challenge now. I just find that element, I would have loved a bit more detail, whereas there was a lot of detail about Krista's life herself, which is fascinating, really interesting. Her childhood is such an incredible story, but I just also had listened to Hidden Valley Road, which is the story of a family with 12 children, six of whom have schizophrenia. And I found that to be a really amazing balance between the story about the family and the science and the history of schizophrenia, which was fascinating. And I think I wanted this book to kind of follow a more similar format. And it didn't, which was just a little bit lacking for me. But actually, I can see why somebody wouldn't want all of that detail that I was looking for and would just find this book absolutely fascinating. I really enjoyed it, though.
Yeah, it sounds really interesting. Did it say anything about why this donor was such a sought-after person?
It does, yeah. So he was tall, blonde, blue-eyed, but also talked a lot about spirituality and music and arts in his sort of biography. Whereas apparently at the time, lots of the people who were kind of giving sperm donations were doing this more for, as a almost more like a scientific experiment. So they say that he was flicking through the brochure of all the other men that had done this to get some inspiration of what to write in his little biography, and realised that most of them were doctors in particular. They were medical students or doctors who were thinking, this is an important thing that I'm doing to sort of further science and kind of help people in a way that I want to help people as a doctor. And because he had his physical traits, which, you know, over 6 foot, fair hair, tan skin, that kind of very classic all-American kind of look, mm-hmm. and also talked about stuff that wasn't just like science, that made people think, oh, I'd love my child to have some of these traits, which is really interesting.
I would love to know how much these days you get to, what the selection process is these days. I don't know about sperm donation, but with adoption, that's certainly changed a lot in the last like 50 years. One of my uncles was adopted, and the way that they did it was like, you basically like went to the place and chose a child in a very kind of odd way that you definitely can't do now. Mm. I'd be very interested to know what it's like these days. I do know a few people that have had childs via donation, but I don't know. Have had childs?
I was thinking about some interesting choice of language.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, I have no idea how much choice you kind of get. I know that there's like a basic health check that the donors go through.
Yeah, well, and that's one of the things that comes up in the book, is that some of that was not done back in the 80s and 90s. So there's some really interesting themes around mental health, which, as I say, tied actually really interestingly for me with Hidden Valley Road. But it's a really, really good book. It's really, really interesting. As I say, that's just one element that was missing for me, but I think that's a personal choice. I can see why this is really popular. Krista is a writer anyway. That's her background. Her husband is also a journalist for Vanity Fair, I think. It's sharp, it's well edited, it's well written. And as I say, she reads it herself. So the emotion is very there in the book, and the emphasis is in the right place, because I definitely find with some audiobooks that when somebody else is reading it, they put emphasis on whatever they think is appropriate. Whereas if it's read by the author, it's actually just as they intended. And that's really, really cool. I really like that.
Yeah, nice. So you recommend the audiobook?
I do. I really do.
Cool. Yeah, I might check that out. Sounds really interesting.
What about you? Are you reading anything currently?
I am, yeah. I just picked up yesterday, actually, These Ghosts Are Family by Macy Card, which I'm reading my book club, actually. It's my book club book for August. So it's set in America, but it's about a man who is Jamaican, and he's quite old at the beginning of the book. He's actually, I think he's 80, he's like 88, he's close to death. And you find out in the first chapter that he is someone who is living under a false name, and then it tells you what happened. And what happened is that when he was young, he and with one other Jamaican guy were working on a like ship together in the US, and they were the only people who weren't white on the whole ship. And the other guy died in a horrible accident, and because of like racism, they thought that he had died. They got confused between the two of them, and the other guy had a much better life than he did. He had a wife that he didn't like, a child that he wasn't really interested in supporting, so he took the opportunity to take on this guy's identity. and he gets declared as dead.
Wow, that's so cool.
Yeah, it's very, what's that Daphne du Maurier book, The Scapegoat? Yeah. It's very like that. And so it opens with this. This is not a spoiler. It starts off like this. And then he's now at the end of his life and he's sort of thinking about how that was not probably the best thing to do. And he just sort of abandoned this woman and his daughter. And he's preparing to tell his family. The daughter from his sort of previous life, he has got her to come and see him under like some kind of false pretense because she's a carer, I think. And he's also got his children who are like his, whatever you call them, his legitimate children, the ones that he's acknowledged. They're all coming to his house and he's going to tell them what's been happening. So that's the start of the book. And then it goes back to him in the 60s when he's living in Jamaica. And you get to hear a bit more of the context of his life. So far, I'm really, really enjoying it. It's quite beautiful writing. It's a debut. If I say easy literary fiction, do you know what I mean? Like, it's quite beautiful, but very easy to get through. It reminds me quite a lot of that book we read by Bernadine Evaristo.
Mr. Loverman. Yeah, I was just thinking that.
Got a very similar kind of well-written, but easy to get through. Yeah, I'm really enjoying it so far. It's very intriguing. It's been a while since I read a kind of enticing plot. I'm enjoying it thus far.
Yeah, what was that called again?
These Ghosts Are Family by Macy Card.
Ooh, okay, I'm definitely going to look that one up. That sounds amazing. Really pretty cover. Jenny'd love that. Mm. Oh, I feel like we need to do a shout out to Jenny because she has just given birth to baby number two, a little boy. Everyone is happy and healthy and well and... that's the most important thing. But we're very excited for Jenny and her whole family. So congrats, Jenny. Yeah,
congratulations, Jen. Very happy for you. Very relieved.
Yes.
Really thrilled for her.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah, so Jenny will be a little absent for the pod in the next couple of months.
Yeah.
She's already quiet. She was texting me yesterday. She said, I'm already delirious. It's been about 2 days.
To be fair, my understanding is that the first, like, week in particular, I mean, it's all time with a newborn is just intense and insane from what I can gather. But the first kind of few days when your hormones are going up and down and you've suddenly gone from getting some sleep to absolutely no sleep, your whole body just goes into like total shock. And also you're recovering from birth, which is quite an intense thing in and of itself. And you've got to keep a new tiny person alive. So it's no wonder that she's feeling a bit delirious.
I love the name as well. I don't know if we're allowed to say it, but we'll just drop that in.
Yeah, good name.
That's a super name.
Very good name.
Love it.
She's doing well.
We just want to take a break to let you know about the ways that you can support the podcast. A really effective and free way of showing your support is by rating and reviewing us on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcasts. There is a link in the show notes that will take you straight to the Apple Podcast page. You can also share our posts on social media. We are at Bookcast Club on both Instagram and Twitter. We also write a monthly newsletter, which you can sign up to on our website, which is www.bookcastclub.com. If you want to support the podcast financially, we do have a Patreon account. You can sign up for as little as $2 a month, and then we have a couple of tiers from there. We offer early access to the podcast, monthly bonus episodes, personalized book recommendations, and books in the post. The link will be in our show notes. But however you choose to support us, we want you to know that we really appreciate it, and thank you for listening. All right, so we thought we'd talk today about books that have like a strong sense of place, right?
Yes.
That was the idea.
Absolutely.
I feel like we both love books like this. Is that true?
Yeah, I think so. I think both of us, our favourites, really have this as a key theme. And I know Jenny also really likes books with a really strong sense of place, but in a slightly different way to us. So Jenny's obviously got an enormous love of gothic fiction. And in most of those, the house is... essentially an extra character, and I know she really loves that, but I think we like books that the setting is broader than that. Would that be fair?
Yeah, as I was scrolling through my Storygraph looking for books to talk about today, actually, I realised that that's kind of how I think back on a book. If I look at a book that I've read and I can kind of remember the location and the like setting of it, to me that's like a more memorable book. I think it's really closely associated with how fondly I remember the book.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I was looking at my bookcase just kind of across the room from me over there, and I was like, oh yeah, I remember loving that book. Couldn't tell you where it's at. Love that book. Couldn't say anything about it. It definitely makes a book more memorable for me. Really, really does. I've just seen another book. What? There we go. There's another book I was going to add to my list. I was like looking over and I'm like, oh yeah, that one had a really clear sense of space and a really famous way. So I'm going to write that one down.
Oh, mystery. Stay tuned. For me also, temperature. I have a bit of a thing about temperature. If I know the temperature, not the specific temperature in terms of the degrees centigrade, but if I know if someone's cold and the description of them being cold is really good or hot. I really, really like that.
Interesting.
Is that weird?
I mean, yeah, I think a little bit. Like, what have you got any examples? I can't think of any books that would have that.
Well, immediately I think of that scene in The Secret History, the winter in The Secret History, where Richard is really cold.
Yes.
And it describes how he's cold for months, basically. And it's like the way that he's chattering. Now he wakes up with his muscles are aching because they've been trembling all night. Mm,
that's a really, really good example, actually. But I think the setting in Secret History is so, so important to the whole book.
Yeah,
that totally. I think I agree with you. But for me, it's more the kind of the campus and the surrounding New England kind of area and landscape that's more memorable for me in that book than the bit where he's absolutely freezing, even though that's a really good bit of the book.
For me, it's really like this. She does these seasons because there's sort of the summer where they're at the sort of house, the sort of summer house, and it's really hot and like Camilla gets the cut on her foot and they're sort of lazily drinking all day and like they're not playing croquet, but they're playing something like that. And there's that, she sort of evokes that kind of lazy summer drunkenness. And then there's sort of the autumn where they're like walking around and driving and they go to like estate sales. And then there's the winter. For me, there's something about the way she does seasons is just incredible.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right. I think the setting there, though, helps that because New England has such clear seasons. And this is a really interesting point because Richard grew up in LA, I think, or California, where the seasons are much less distinct. And I think that's possibly part of it, of him feeling like an outsider almost because he's not used to these kind of real seasons and big differences between how it feels in the summer and how it feels in the winter and how the year kind of fades through, perhaps.
Mm. I actually have as top of my list all Donna Tartt books. So yeah, there's The Secret History, of course, which is both of our favourite books. Both of our favourite? Whatever, you know what I'm saying. We both like
it. We both like it a lot.
Yeah, we do. And I think The Goldfinch as well also has a really strong sense of place, especially, well, all parts of it actually. But I mean, I know Amsterdam, I guess, but especially the scenes where he's in Amsterdam, I find those to be, really strong.
See, interestingly, where I was going to say the scenes in Vegas are really, really strong. And I love how that whole section just stretches out in this really languid, long, slow way that really reflects the days that they were having there, just lying by the pool, this empty pool, if memory serves.
Yeah, exactly.
And just baking in the extreme desert heat there versus, yeah, then going to New York and Amsterdam where it's absolutely freezing in comparison.
And the way she describes the emptiness of those new subdivisions in Nevada, they are, right? Yeah, Las Vegas. Oh, it's just incredible. You can, like, hear it. And then The Little Friend as well. Have you read The Little Friend?
I've actually not, no. It's been on my list for a while, but I've just never got around to picking it up.
So that's set in, I can't remember which state it's set in, but it's in the South and it's hot. And the main character is a child. She's 12. And so she and her best friend, they kind of do like these long afternoons. They have this, what's it called? That thing that kids have that they pull. Oh my God, what is it called? It's like a little trailer thing that they can pull, like four wheels.
Yeah, like the little red kind of trailer truck.
Yeah, with a stick.
Yeah, I know what you mean, yeah.
So yeah, she has one of those which she pulls around and they go like across abandoned train tracks and they see like snakes and stuff. It's very similar to in The Goldfinch where Theo and Boris are kind of spending their teenage years languishing in the desert. It's got a very, but sort of a younger child's perspective. So they're kind of playing silly games and the way that she describes how hot it is inside because it's just hot everywhere. Yeah, it's really, really, really good.
It does sound such a good book. I don't know why I haven't actually read it yet. I think it's a bit like To Paradise by Hanya Yanagihara, how I've mm-hmm. got it sitting on the side of my bed and I can't pick it up because I'm worried I won't like it as much as A Little Life. So I think I feel a bit like this with The Little Friend, that I'm worried I won't like it as much as her other books.
It's very different to her other books. I feel like every time she writes a novel, she kind of pushes in a completely different direction. So it's very, very different from The Secret History. It's just sort of this long, languid plot. In The Secret History she writes, which is her first novel, it's quite tight and it's quite plot-driven, actually, even though it's so character-heavy. And then in The Little Friend, she kind of goes completely the opposite direction, where it's this long, slow plot with basically no resolution. And then in The Goldfinch, she kind of pulls that back again, and it's kind of also long and slow, but it's a little bit tighter. So I feel like she kind of, in The Little Friend, she sort of pushed how much she could do that kind of long character exploration as much as she could, if you know what I mean. So I think it's a good one to read, like as a fan of hers, it's just cool to read, to see this kind of, yeah, I just felt like she was trying to push it a bit to see how much she could stretch out describing a single scene or a single afternoon.
That's so cool.
So yeah, I love it. And it's about, it's a, I don't know if you know the plot, it's about a family whose child died by mysterious circumstances. And so the younger sister of this boy, she's trying to figure out what happened. So she's kind of this weird kid detective, but obviously she's like 10 or something. So she never, I mean, she can't do anything. So you just sort of get this child's perspective trying to figure out what happened to her brother. But through her eyes, you get to see just how broken this family is. But that she doesn't really understand as a child, like why her mother is so absent. Like, for example, the mother never feeds them. And it doesn't even occur to her to feed her child, her children, because she's just completely saturated with grief. Like she cannot function. But you don't really see this directly, because Harriet, the main character, just kind of says these things, and you kind of have to read between the lines with just how shattered the family is. And I just think it's just brilliant.
Sounds amazing. It really does sound amazing. The other thing for me that I just realised on this is that Secret History came out 30 years ago. That book is...
Yeah, it came out the year I was born.
It's insane. It's absolutely insane. Blows my mind.
So I think Goldfinch was 2013, I believe, and...
The Little Friend was 2002.
Yeah, so where'd you?
Yeah, this year. Or next, probably next year. I feel like there'd have been some hype if it was happening soon. Yeah.
Can you imagine? This is, oh my God, I don't know.
Come on, Donatart.
I think I'd probably literally take the day off work to read.
It's a fair point. It's a very fair point. It's a good idea.
Yeah, I don't know what I'd do with myself. I'd also be so nervous to read it. Oh my God.
But on a similar note, the other one that I read recently that I loved was If We Were Villains, which had a very similar campus kind of New England campus kind of vibe and setting, and that was amazingly described. Like, I thought that was absolutely incredible, and how they talk about doing these Shakespearean reenactments or these performances, sorry, of these plays. And the one that really stands out to my mind is using the lake on the campus in Macbeth, and how the witches are, they emerge from the lake, and the lake actually forms like a really key space within the book. Lots of stuff goes down there, and it's amazingly described. And it is very similar to The Secret History, in the climate is very similar. So the seasons are described really well, and you know, the trees turning and how this space fits together. Really, really, it really sang in my mind. I could really vividly imagine where this was and how this all worked, but. Yeah, love a campus novel. I know we've talked about this a lot before, but I love a campus novel.
Yeah, I found the dialogue really annoying in If We Were Villains, but I'm glad you liked it. Something about it irritated me.
Really? Was it the fact they just talked in Shakespearean quotes a lot? Because I thought that was really funny.
I think I found it pretentious in a way that, because like pretentious writing is funny, like because The Secret History is also pretentious. Mm. Like I can't be like, oh, I don't like it when they're pretentious. It's a very pretentious novel. But something about it, I just found it too labored or something. I don't know. I think probably any book that presents itself to me as being something like The Secret History is in a bad position, right? So I wish people wouldn't say that, actually, because there's a couple of books that I've read that have been in reviews, people say that, and then I read it thinking of The Secret History and then I don't like it.
Yeah, I think that's really fair.
I was probably just being bitter.
Fair enough. I loved it. I thought it was great. But...
Who's your next one?
Next on my list is, well, I think kind of, I was thinking about fantasy as a broad genre, and obviously world building in fantasy is such an important thing that gives such a good sense of place. So not that we tend to talk about these very often on the podcast, but the Harry Potter books really do have such an amazing sense of place, and Hogwarts in particular and how it's described. I just reread the first Harry Potter book because I was at my mum's, and again I'd somehow forgotten to take a book with me. Not quite sure how this keeps happening. Like, it's very weird and annoying, but I had that one at home at my mum's, so it's like, oh, I'll just read it, it'll take, because I can read this in the 2 days I'm here. And I was like, gosh, I really remember as a child reading this and just vividly being able to imagine Hogwarts and the Hogwarts Express and running through the barrier at King's Cross. It's all, the locations within Harry Potter are described in a really good way, annoyingly well. And I guess that's true of like Game of Thrones and Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit as well. They all just go into so much depth about what these places look like. And even though it's completely somewhere that you can't visit, you get this real sense of place. And I think the really good thing about these is when they've made films and TV series out of them all, I don't think I've had anybody say, oh, that place isn't how I had imagined it. You know, you have characters who aren't how you'd imagine, but the places, I think, tend to come across really, really clearly in all of those books in a way that nobody goes, I didn't really picture King's Landing like that. I didn't really picture the Shire like that. And I think it's really clever. I really love that.
Yeah, Game of Thrones is awesome for that, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think you haven't read Robin Hood, but Robin Hood as well is really, really, really cool. I love fantasy novels for that. I put Hannah Kent's novels. So you've read Burial Rites, right?
No, I've not. No, Jenny's read Burial Rites, yeah.
So all three of her novels, so she wrote Burial Rites, then The Good People, then Devotion. She's an Australian author. Burial Rites was kind of a very buzzy book when it came out. It's set in Iceland, and it's about the last person who was hanged in Iceland as capital punishment. And it's about her as a prisoner and how they kind of deal with her, because Iceland's so small, they basically don't have a prison. And so they kind of put her in the houses of people who live there, and they have to kind of look after her. But it's such a, like, grim, dark, wet, cold novel. And the way that they describe Iceland, because it's also, I think it's winter. Or if it's not winter, it's like, it's not summer. So it's closing in on winter. The way that they describe, like, the perils of going somewhere, how everything ices over, the lack of warmth, the lack of sunlight, the wind and that kind of stuff. It's just incredible. I think it's one of the strongest senses of place I've ever read in a book, actually. And the audiobook especially, I listen to the audiobook and it's just incredible. That is definitely a recommendation. And then The Good People is set in Ireland in the 1890s, I think, and it's set in quite a rural and isolated place. Again, the way that she describes these kind of farms and the animals and the way that they kind of live on top of their animals and the smells of it, and the smells of the other people, and it's about a group of women who are all kind of outcasts in this sort of small village. And the way that she describes how they see the other people and how the people kind of pretend that they're not there, you just get this incredible feeling and sense in your head about how everyone's like looking at each other and not looking at each other, and how they walk down to the stream and it's kind of muddy and cold. It's just like incredible.
It really does sound so, so good. I've just, yeah, opened all of those up and added them to my TBR list, because I'm not quite sure how I've not read any because my brain just slowed down as I was halfway through a word. That was great. It's not even that early on Sunday. I was going to say it's early on Sunday morning, but it's like 10:40. That's not even early. I've got no excuse. It's warm. That's what I'm going to use as my excuse. It's warm. And I'm British, so I can't cope. Anyway, right. I've just opened up all of those books and have added them to my TBR, because I can't really understand how I've not read any Hannah Kent before.
Yeah, I'm surprised you haven't read Burial Rites, actually. It seems like your kind of thing.
Yeah, I've got it here, and I just, from the way you've talked about it, and I'm sure the way Jenny's talked about it as well, I'm not sure how I've managed to miss that one. It sounds really, really good. Although I'm apparently on a book buying ban. Have I told you about this before?
No. Who did this to you?
Rob. He says that I buy too many books. My theory is that I buy a lot of books and I read a lot of books, whereas he buys a lot of books and then has got loads of bookshelves with lots of unread books on them.
So he's projecting.
He's projecting. But also he keeps telling me to read certain books. And actually, this does mean that I have to give Down and Out in Paris and London a shout out. Because I was talking to Rob about this topic. And I was like, you know, what books do you think have got a really good sense of place? And he was like, Down and Out in Paris and London. But you've not read that. So even though I've told you to read it about 6 times and you had it on your pile at one point and then it disappeared off there. So here is my public apology to Rob for not reading the book he recommended to me. And it's set in like the restaurant world of Paris and London. And is it George Orwell?
Yeah, he's a guy.
It's meant to be brilliant, and I feel very bad that I haven't read it. So
it sounds like Rob's got an axe to grind.
He really does, right? So I need to read it, and then I'm going to be allowed to buy more books. But yeah, what else on this? Oh, Where the Crawdads Sing, Adelia Owens. Incredible scent. That's the one that I was like, oh, I'm looking over at my bookcase, and I've just seen it, and why was that not listed on there? The marsh, quite an important distinction, which is made right at the beginning of the book, is such an incredibly described place. And it's somewhere that I could really clearly visualise, despite never having been to like North Carolina or South Carolina, whichever of the Carolinas it's set in. Despite, I've never been there, I've never been in that kind of marshy, environment, like coastal US, where there's all these birds and insects and animals of varying types, an incredible ecosystem that I've never been in. And I could picture it, and I could vividly imagine it. And when I went to see the film a couple of weeks ago with some friends, I was like, oh yeah, this is pretty much how I would imagine this to be.
My next one is Boy Swallows Universe by Trent Dalton, which is a super famous Australian book.
Did we read this as a book club book, or did I read this with my book club? I think I did.
I think you might have read it all by yourself.
I think I read it all by myself. Check me out.
I chose it because it's the way that it describes Australia to me is very true to how I feel about Australia, or how I experience Australia. So if you want to read a book set in Australia and you're not Australian yourself and you want to sort of, I don't know, feel that vibe, this is the book I would recommend. It's like the most Australian novel, if you know what I mean. And the way that, especially the way that his family, because the main character is a teenager, or he's like 12, I think. The way that his parents talk to him, and the way that he talked to his friends, and like the whole way that his sort of neighborhood works, is very true to what I think Australia is. So the truest Australian novel that I've read, I think.
Yeah, I completely understand what you mean. And I feel very similarly about Daphne du Maurier's books, and particularly Jamaica Inn, actually. So I grew up probably about an hour or so away from Jamaica Inn, where it's all set. And the way she describes the moorland, which is, I grew up on a different moor, but the same kind of vibe in a similar sort of area. And the way she describes it, and particularly the mist, which I know sounds like a really weird thing to pick up on, but the mist on Dartmoor is such a specific type of fine fog, mist, drizzle that you just don't really get in very many other places in the UK, because where I grew up, it was like one of the first high points off the Atlantic. So all the clouds roll in off the Atlantic and just stop there. So you're living in a cloud. Daphne du Maurier really, really captures this sense of the fog rolling in, the mist kind of sitting across the moors in a way that so few people can really capture and gather. It comes up a little bit in Hound of the Baskervilles as well, because that's actually set exactly where I grew up. Like the village that's mentioned in it and the prison, I could see that from my bedroom window at my mum's. I can't see the prison, but I can see the village. And I love being able to read somewhere in a book that is exactly how it is in real life. And yeah, love them. Daphne du Maurier is so good at place.
Yeah,
so good.
Totally. I really like Jamaica Inn as well. And I remember, when I read it, I didn't know that it was a real place. And then afterwards, I think either you or Jenny sent me a photo of Jamaica Inn. And I was like, yep, that's exactly what I pictured. It's her descriptions are amazing, actually. She really has that kind of rural English Maori description down.
She really, really does. And yeah, Mandalay and the rhododendrons as you go down the path. Every time I see rhododendrons, I'm like, we're on our way to Mandalay. It's amazing.
Yeah, also the scapegoat. There are two characters who essentially swap identities, and so he ends up in this kind of estate, and the way that she describes the estate is just like, you just can picture it exactly. Yeah, it's really good. And then The House on the Strand is the other one of hers that I've read, and the main character is like tripping the whole time, basically.
Amazing.
She describes the trip. Like, you really can get in his head. It's pretty cool.
Love that.
She's really something. That du Maurier, I think she'll really go places.
Absolutely. You know, I don't think she's really been heard of very much outside of, you know, literary circles. Agatha Christie, in a similar way, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Really great. You know, particularly books like Death on the Nile and Murder on the Orient Express, where it's such, and actually, And Then There Were None as well, it's such an enclosed space, and the whole thing happens, you know, in a train carriage, on a steamship, in a, you know, house on a tiny island off the coast of Devon, and they're all amazingly well described, and you really do feel like you're in these slightly claustrophobic, very specific settings in a quite similar way, I think, to Daphne du Maurier. But it works really, really well, obviously, in a murder mystery.
My last one is a little different. It's A Brief History of Seven Killings by Marlon James. Now, we love Marlon James on this podcast. Great podcast that he has. This is set in Jamaica. Huge cast, very complicated politics. You've got gangs on different sides of whatever, their enemy gangs. And he's got Bob Marley is in it. And the way that he describes the kind of tension between the different gangs that are in Jamaica at the time, the what happens when Bob Marley, who he just calls the singer, and what happens when he's in Jamaica and how that kind of affects where everyone's going, and he's kind of this tense presence and what's going to happen and can we see him and all that kind of thing. The way he sets it is incredible. It's very different, obviously, to the other novels that we've described, because you're in this kind of hot tropical place, but the way that he writes this kind of tension and this heat is brilliant. So that I recommend as well.
That does sound so good. I've heard such good things about that book and I've just not read it, so...
It's complex. It's not one that I would recommend to just pick up. I actually had to restart it once I was like 100 pages in, because he just sort of says what that is. There's not like a whole lot of sort of hand-holding, and there's a big, big cast of characters. So it sort of took me a while to like get my head around who, because there's all of these different points of view, who is even like friends with who and like who's in the same gang and who are enemies and who are not. So once you sort of get your head around all of the cast, then I kind of went back because I was like, okay, I've kind of got it who everyone is now. Now I need to figure out the plot. So it's really, really good, but yeah, he doesn't make it easy. He doesn't have a lot of mercy on you as a reader. He just puts you in there.
I kind of love that, though. It's really cool.
Yeah.
Actually, that did make me think of one other book that might be my last one, which was a book that I didn't love, but I'm keen to actually reread, which is A Theatre for Dreamers by Polly Sampson. And the reason I didn't love it is that until the very end, I didn't really twig that all of the people in the book are real people. And now I know that, so I kind of want to go back and reread it. But that's set on one of the Greek islands called Hydra, and this was basically like an artist's community, so like poets and painters and musicians, and including Leonard Cohen and a whole load of other kind of real people, Charmaine Clift, George Johnston. A young girl goes to this island with her brother because they've heard amazing things about what it's like there, and I think like a friend of their mother's has a house there, and it's like, yeah, cool, just come and spend some time. And it's an amazing, amazing description of what it's like living on this island, and you know, the steps going up kind of the cliffs through kind of the village up into the top, and you know, the places that they sort of hang out in each individual person's house. And it really, really does describe it so incredibly well that you really could imagine what it's like being there. Now, this is, I think, easier when it's a real place and a real island where there's lots of pictures of how these people lived, and you could even go there now, and it, because it's Greek, it hasn't changed in hundreds and hundreds of years. But I thought that was an amazing sense of place and a real
cool,
really good kind of island vibes about it, which I love. I was thinking this tied really well together with our conversation in the beginning about your holidays, so
it sure did, full circle.
Absolutely.
Love it. Yeah, this was great. I love these kind of books, strong sense of place.
Same.
My favorites.
Yeah, they really are something special.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope you got some recommendations, and if you have books that you think Alice and I would like, please let us know. If you would like to contact us with questions, ideas, feedback, recommendations, whatever, you can email us at thebookcastclub@outlook.com, or you can message us on Twitter or Instagram. We are at bookcastclub on both of those. I should say we are planning on doing a Q&A episode at the end of September, I think, right, Alice? Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? I think so.
Yeah, so if you have questions for us, I think all four of us are going to do that episode if we can get a recording date down. So if you have questions, send them in. Questions of any kind, really. Mostly book related, I guess, but whatever.
Anything goes. We can just choose not to answer things.
We'll just lie.
Yeah.
No, yeah, anything is fine. Yeah, you can sign up to our newsletter as well. As I said in the ad break, we have reviews on there, new releases, podcast recommendations, and updates on the Bookcast Club. And you can also check out our Patreon if you would like to support the podcast financially. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode.